Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 827. It's the 14th of July, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Paul Athley, Managing Director of Barclay Energia, that's BKY ticker, and Paul talks about their recent progress, including the delivery of the primary crusher to the mining site, which means the company has now progressed from its development phase to the construction phase. Also on the podcast, Brian Larking, Managing Director of United Oil and Gas, UOG, which will be floating next week. You can follow it on Vox Markets, but they're not listed yet. But Brian talks about their investment strategy. Plus, it's a Friday, so Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the following stocks. Carillion, which he wrote a piece for, I think, in the week for one of the broadsheets, I think. Crichton's, Manx Telecom, Connect, and Ramsden's. Plus, Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, talks about US interest rates, UK credit, and what to look out for next week in the figures. Plus, I also have, as always, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And it's pretty much a measure of money. You know, people only follow a stock for two reasons. Either they're investing in the stock already, in that stock, or they're doing research and looking to invest. So it's a good metric. I also have the top five most liked RNSs on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Athley, Managing Director of Barclay Energia. That's BKY. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Nice to talk to you again, Justin.
Yeah, we haven't spoken for a while, but you know, both of us have not stopped still. You definitely haven't stopped still, kept busy there. And we'll get into exactly what you've been doing. But before we do that, Paul, for people listening who've not heard of the company, could you just summarise what it's all about, Barclay Energia, please?
Thank you, Justin. We're building the only major uranium mine in the world that's being built today. It's in western Spain. We're pouring concrete right at the bottom of the uranium price cycle, and we have just commenced construction.
Yeah, so it's an exciting time. And so going back, so let's have a look at what you've done this year. I mean, you've raised some money last year. So at the moment, you've just announced, like you say, you've ordered this crusher. So you've gone to construction of the mine. But take us through some of the highlights in the last 6 months since we haven't spoken, Paul, that sticks out in your head.
Last October, we went to the institutional market to raise, we needed $15 million to progress the development of the project. We were massively oversubscribed. We took $30 million, but could have taken 15, these by the biggest institutions in London. And that was at a time when the uranium price hit 12-year lows. Mm. So clearly, they were very, very excited about the ability to finance us at a time when we are pouring concrete at literally the bottom of the uranium price cycle. So we've gone away, taken that money, manufactured a big crusher, primary crusher in Finland through Sandvik, and we've just brought that to site. And we're now in the beginning stages of building the mine.
Yeah, and so you've got an offtake agreement in place, haven't you, already? And that's, is the offtake around about 40? $3, I think, is that right?
That's correct. And the spot uranium price is around $20 a pound. And we've got forward contracts averaging $43 a pound over a 5-year period from 2019. And we're looking to put more of those in place. And the reason we can do that is two reasons. One is because the spot market is very thin. It's just basically casual trades rather than any form of term contract. So the term contract traditionally done at significantly higher than the spot price. So there's nothing unusual about that. But what's attractive to the utilities about our mine is we're based in Western Europe. The last uranium mine closed in Western Europe. And most of the world's utilities are in either Europe or the US. So they're looking for an opportunity to move away their supply contracts from Kazakhstan, Russia, and Niger to a mine that's going to be developed in the heart of the European Union.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And at the moment, so how much, like I said, you've started construction here, but how much do you need to get into production then, Paul?
That's a good question. We have around $30 million in the bank, and obviously we've been spending quite a lot of that. And so we've said consistently that we need around $100 million to develop this up front. So we're now in the final stages of bringing on strategic financing. We've been talking about this for some time. It is due around now. So fingers crossed we'll be able to finalize that and make some form of announcement in relation to the financing so that we can demonstrate we are fully funded to complete the construction of the mine.
Yeah, now what's the thoughts around uranium? Because I was just, you know, the other day I was looking around and everyone's going talking about electric cars and going clean and getting rid of diesel and petrol. And then I sort of read an article and someone pointed out that to get all these electric cars on the road would require a lot of power stations being built. And how are power stations, you know, fueled? And they're either coal, which is old, dirty sort of, sort of substance, or uranium, pretty much. So I'm thinking, surely the future is bright here for uranium, isn't it?
Definitely. Overall, electricity demand is going to grow, as you've indicated, for a number of reasons, not least of which electric cars. But we also want clean electricity, and at the moment, as much as we all want renewables to come on the stream, we have a problem when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. We need to generate what's called base load, and most countries have said we don't want base load from fossil fuels, i.e. coal. Therefore, nuclear has a very, very big future. What we're seeing, though, is because we mentioned before, we're at the bottom of the uranium price cycle. There are no uranium mines coming on stream, so there are 65 nuclear reactors being built on the world around the world today and no new mines. So we're in this very, very good position where we're the only major mine coming on stream at a time where we can see massive demand from uranium for around 2019 onwards.
Yeah, and when are you hoping to start producing then, Paul?
Well, we're starting constructing now. It'll be about 12 months and a few months commissioning. So we say, although we'll produce in the second half of 2018, we're saying first full year of production will ramp up during 2019.
Yeah, yeah. I remember a while back, I can't remember the exact figure there, but you had some figures of how much you'll be earning, so profit-wise. Take us through this. I don't know if it's changed, but I remember I was quite impressed at the time. What were the figures here?
Ben Davies from Liberum, who's probably the most conservative analyst covering us, he has us producing around $150 million US free cash flow from as we ramp up to from full production from 2019 onwards as we build up to that number. So you can say this mine that will generate free cash flow $150 million US dollars, and we've got a market capitalization of roughly 120 million pounds sterling. So we are on a very, very low free cash flow multiple as soon as we get into production.
Yeah. So why do you think that is at the moment? I mean, are people not believing this uranium story will take off, or why do you think that is? Or is it just the place where you're at the moment?
No, it's just the stage we're at. Obviously, the stock's tripled, even though the uranium price has halved over the last 2 years, the stock's tripled, as you know, and there's this sort of waiting period as we're going into, sort of the point we get to now. And I think, you know, if you were to ask me what the main catalysts were for the share price, I think we're just nailing them. One is they want to confirm the capital. The capital costs are going to be the numbers we said, which we have. We announced that. Secondly, is construction going to commence? Yes, we've announced that. And we've probably got a couple of other things to come up. One would be, as we mentioned, we've got to demonstrate the financing. Mm-hmm. And that's due shortly. And then also, if we can put some more offtake in place, then that confirms. And once you've got all those in place, then people can start seeing that cash flow is real and deliverable. And then we expect a very strong re-rating on the back of that.
Yeah, well, do you know what? There was a time when I thought your share price would never come back. It kept going up and up and up. And I thought, wow. As an investor, I never like to chase a share price. But right now, you've got an interesting situation where you've got the fundamentals stacking up, you know, in your favour, and even long-term, looking at uranium and the market. And yet, your share price has come off a bit. And I'm thinking, this is a very interesting chart to look at, especially with your story. So I think, you know, like, this is not investment advice. Do your own research, everyone listening. But I would check out the story behind Buckley Energy and look at the chart as well, because it's in a very interesting period in your life, and also I think it's reflecting the chart, like you said.
If I can just jump in there on one point, because you've made a very, very good point. During this period when we've been a little bit quiet, there's been what people have got tired of the stock and they've sold, it's interesting to see who have bought during that period. Yeah. And Fidelity, one of our biggest shareholders, have been buying. In fact, they made a substantial shareholder notice the other day. So here's a bit of a clue. During this quiet period, it's the institutions who are buying, and let's say some of the retail and more disconnected shareholders who, through lack of news, have sold into that. So I think that can reverse. I think what can happen is once we get these key bits of information out, hopefully in the near future, then people can start turning around again and we'll see the stock are starting to re-rate.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's always, I think, you know, the time to look at it, when you've done your research on a company, the time to start buying is when it's quiet. You know, it's people who lose on investing are people who just chase hot stocks all the time because, you know, you should never do that. Just do your own research, wait for the price to come to you, and that's an ideal time, I find. But very interesting. Paul, listen, for anyone listening right now and they're not following Barclay Energy, on Vox, but thinking, this sounds very interesting. Give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
Number one is because we've got some announcements coming up over these key catalysts. They're the thing that market's waiting for. If we can get the financing announced and get some more offtake announced, then I think that'll be a re-rating. Secondly, we're incredibly geared to the uranium price. The way the uranium price works is that it's on 12-year lows, got massive demand coming, no new mines are being built in the world, and as people have previously reported, when the uranium price runs, it does just double, it doesn't treble, it goes up five times. The last time the uranium price ran, it goes up 22 times. So I think just on those two reasons alone, you can buy it. The third one is that when the uranium price does run, there's a huge following. There'll be a lot of people following the stock, so you'll be in good company. So the time to own a uranium stock is when nobody's looking. Buy the best asset, bottom the market before the market turns.
Marvellous. Paul, thanks for the chat. Like you said, you've got lots of news coming up, so hopefully we'll chat again very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Same. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil & Gas at UOG ticker. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now, people may not have heard of you. They can be forgiven for that, because you're not yet listed. And when are you going to be listing, Brian?
We're planning on completing the listing at the end of July. But by way of introduction, we are a former Tullow Oil team, and our strategy is to acquire oil and gas licenses with near-term activity and where we can unlock value for our shareholders fairly quickly.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so at the moment, so end of July, you'll be listing UOG's ticker. By the way, people can go on Vox Markets right now and they can hit the follow button. So when you do list, they'll know the exact time and day. But so take us in a bit more detail then, Brian. So where are you looking geographically? Where are you looking at the moment?
Well, our initial focus has been Europe, and to date we've completed two deals. The first one we completed on August 16, which is a onshore UK license. That license is located right next door to Witch Farm, which, as I'm sure you know, is Europe's largest onshore producing oil field. And we plan on drilling a well in that field in January 2018. In addition to the UK license, we've recently completed a farm-in option agreement. We completed that in May for an Italian onshore license, and we intend on drilling United's first well in October of this year on that field. So our focus has been Europe initially, but as a management team coming out of Tullow, we have a lot of experience in regions such as South America and Africa, and we plan on looking at opportunities in those regions on an opportunistic basis.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, looking for assets are concerned, you know, what do they have to meet? The criteria-wise, you know, what boxes do they have to tick there, Brian?
Well, I guess for us, it's about the strategy and about delivering value for shareholders. So what we like is we like to see oil and gas licenses where there's activity in the next 6 to 12 months. So, for example, we like to see wells been drilled or seismic acquired, or oil and gas license where there's an opportunity to unlock value, maybe because a technical piece of work needs to be done. So that's kind of the first criteria we look for. Does it fit with our strategy? Then the second one we look at is the capital, the CapEx requirements, and can we make that work for our bandwidth?
Mm-hmm. I understand. Okay, and so essentially, is it just near-term producing, or are you looking to do some exploration as well?
No, it's not necessarily near-term producing focus. The two wells we've got happen to be low risk, potentially near term producing wells. But we are looking at adding licenses across the oil and gas life cycle. So, for example, we would be very interested in looking at exploration, production and development opportunities. And we are currently evaluating several follow-up potential farm-ins and acquisitions, which would be across the whole oil and gas portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. And at the moment, you know, where do you see, because we've had a bit of softness, even though OPEC are trying to, you know, sort of freeze production, we've seen that oil price, you know, hovering just below $50 and towards the $40 a barrel level. I mean, as far as you're concerned, do you have an eye on the macro as well? Does it affect how you look at projects?
It does to a degree. We are very conservative on our view on oil price over the longer term. So any increase in commodity price is straight to the bottom line. But we do actually see a low oil price environment as an opportunity. We see it as an opportunity to create a portfolio of oil and gas licenses at the bottom of the price cycle. So when it invariably washes out, United Oil and Gas would be well positioned with a portfolio of assets that we've acquired in a low-cost environment.
Understand. And as far as you know, mid to long term ambition here for the company, what's your target? What's your aim?
Well, we're going to continue to build the company by acquisition and farming, and we are building an oil and gas company. We've got two deals done. We've got plenty of news on the next 6 months with two wells to drill, and potentially some follow up deals. So we plan to continue to add to the portfolio and grow the business that way.
Mm-hmm. And you touched upon you guys there from previously from Tullow Oil. So give us a bit of background on yourself and some of the main players there, right?
Yeah, well, we're a small management team. I'm the chief executive, as you know. My own background, I'm an accountant, but I have plenty of experience in the oil industry with Tullow and with Providence, working in various financial, commercial and new venture roles. John Letters, our COO. John is a geologist and PhD. He's worked for Shell and for Tullow. In fact, he headed up Tullow's subsurface group and was also a member of Tullow's global exploration leadership team. So between the management team, as it sits, John and I, we have finance on one side and commercial, and on John's side, we have the technical expertise.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, listen, like I said, you are right now on Vox Markets. You're not listening till the end of the month, but people can hit that follow button. So, Brian, if someone's listening right now and they like the sound of this, but they haven't hit that follow button on your page, give them three reasons, please, why they should hit that follow button.
Well, we've got plenty of news flow coming. We've got two wells to drill in the next 6 months, as I've mentioned. They're low-risk wells. So that's certainly one reason. Second reason is we're working on, as I mentioned, on several follow-up potential opportunities. And they are acquisitions and potential farm-ins. So we've plenty of news flow on both acquisition and farm-in and on turning the drill a bit. And in addition to that, we're a new company. We're an exciting startup. So I think the next 6 to 9 months for United Oil & Gas is going to be really exciting.
Good stuff. Okay, Brian, well, thanks for the chat. And hopefully, like you say, you're going to have a busy next 6 months. So hopefully we'll catch up very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well. How are you, Justin?
Not too bad. I'm surprised you're not at Wimbledon or something, you know, one of these exotic sports events.
Not really my sport, actually.
Isn't it?
I don't, you know, not desperately, no. So, I mean, it clearly brings a lot of people a lot of pleasure, and I have no problem with that, but I would, no, not for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, have you ever been? I've been once, and it was just working for a radio station in Capital Radio in London, actually, and it's odd. You go into a court there, and it's quite eerie, the silence at one point. You're scared to cough at one point, you know, but it's a way of getting in, isn't it, via, I think, allocation in some way, or you put your name down.
I think there's a ballot or something.
A ballot, that's right,
but
yeah.
But you then can turn up and queue on the day, because there's a few people in our office who have been doing that, who have been getting their early bird and queuing to get into some of the outer courts, which they seem to have enjoyed and have had a good day. So
I keep forgetting. I have to put my name of the ballot, because I suppose it's one of those things, a nice surprise if it happens, you know, just put your name down, forget about it, and then anyway.
Yes.
Ross, I tell you what I want to ask you about. Someone said you were on the front page of the City this week, and I think it may have been Carillion related, I don't know, but I mean,
a lot of
Carillion now, I mean, you know, a lot of people are sort of taking a punt on it. And I don't know. All I know is that they've got about £800 million worth of debt, and their market cap is what, about 300 or, yeah, 290 odd. So they seem to have a lot of troubles there, but you probably know more about the situation. What's happening at Carillion, Russ?
Well, to be fair, nobody knows, which is why I think your use of the word punts is the correct one, because that's all you're doing is punting, gambling.
Yeah.
Because the company doesn't know what's going on at the moment, and so there's certainly no chance for any of us to know. And, you know, I think the question to start off with is, how on earth can a well-researched FTSE 250 company lose three-quarters of its value in the space of a week?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that in itself raises questions over the quality of some of the research that's been put out there. But I think there are three very simple rules that, you know, retail investors can take. One of which is that if the dividend yield looks too good to be true, then let's face it, frankly, it probably is.
Yeah.
Before, when we were sat here a week last Friday, when Carillion was 190p, it was allegedly paying a 9.5% dividend yield. Now, if you think that cash in the bank is paying you a quarter through the Bank of England, the 10-year bond yield is 1.3%, and the UK stock market is paying 3.8%, maybe 9.5% was achievable. But just think of how much risk you were taking to get that.
Because
clearly, you know, the company had to sort of lure you in with something, and, you know, in the end, there was clearly... So just think, don't just think reward. Think, okay, why on earth am I getting paid 20-odd times the risk-free rate, you know, 10 times the UK government risk-free rate for owning this thing? Well, there must be something potentially lurking around.
Yeah.
So the second thing is, the stock market's never always right, because it can't be, but its views have to be respected. So if the chart's gone from the top left to the bottom right, and you look at charts more often than I do, don't be, you know, by all means, have a look at it, but you're going to have an awfully good reason for doing so. Mr. Market is not stupid. And in this case, when the dividend yield was nearly 10 and the PE was 6, the market was politely saying, I'm awfully sorry, I don't believe the earnings forecasts. And the third one is, you've already mentioned it, it's the debt word. And debt isn't intrinsically bad. If you're a utility or a tobacco stock or someone who sells stuff like Unilever, where your demand is pretty guaranteed and your, you know, your margins are pretty good, you can withstand debt because your earnings don't move around a lot. If you're a company like Carillion, where the operating margin was skinny and it wasn't going to take an awful lot to knock a big hole in those profits, and debt was high, then you have a problem. Because let's look at it here. Operating profit was 145 million quid last year. It had interest income of 14, depreciation of 45, and working capital of 5. So cash in just over 200 million quid. CapEx of 37, paid tax of 4, interest payments of 60, and 50 million quid a year went into the pension. So you've got guaranteed cash out here of 150 million quid. So the difference is basically 50. Your dividend was 42. So how much room for manoeuvre have you got if something goes wrong in that business? The dividend was only one and a bit times covered when things were going well. And you've got to pay your tax, you've got to pay your interest on the bank, you've got to pay the pension top-up. So in that respect, I think the message here is for those people who are punting, is if they've not done the research on the cash flow and they've not done the research on the balance sheet, all I can say is I wish them very good luck. Where does the company go from here? I don't know. And therefore, given that you've got 1,999 other companies in the UK to look at, why take the risk? Again, yes, I can understand the reward angle. There's talk in the FT today of a Chinese bid, but you don't know what the company's going to do. Is it going to do a debt-for-equity swap? Is it going to have a massive rights issue? Is there another profit warning coming? Because generally speaking, these things are like cockroaches. They don't come in ones. And so therefore, it is a gamble. And if that's the way you like to run your portfolio, go into it eyes wide open and accept that it is a punt, and you can write the whole thing off if it goes wrong, fine.
Yeah.
But if you're a risk-averse investor, then frankly, there are much safer dividend play income players out there, and frankly, much safer capital gain options as well, I would think. So really, you've got to go into this eyes wide open, knowing that nobody knows what's going to come out of this. And under those circumstances, I personally fail to see why you'd want to play.
I mean, it's like I was saying, it's an increased level of interest on this stock because of the punt value, the reward value.
No, I understand I understand the contrarian angle completely.
But it's like, you know, for every punt that goes right or wrong, you're probably better off in a longer term looking at a decent sort of level of dividend pay and just reinvesting the dividend, again, 2%, 2-3% and reinvesting it, you know, it don't pay off punts very well. It's like, it is like going to the track, isn't it, you know?
And that's, for me, not what investing is all about. If you're prepared to, you know, do trading, this is trading, and if that's the way you like to run it, by all means. Obviously, you know, value contrarians, you know, they like buying stuff that people detest, and I get that, and it's a great discipline. But in the end, if the balance sheet is this weak, the figure is allegedly £800 million of debt, there's then a pension liability of £663 million. So any cash that gets raised, the pension trustees are going to be pretty much first in line. You know, it's a difficult situation to see how the company can get out of its way. Now, the other old saying to bear in mind, of course, is what is the definition of a stock that has gone down by 90%?
Yeah.
It is one that's fallen by 80 and then halved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so again, I'm not saying don't do this, but just know that once the balance sheet is working against you, time is working against you. And if you talk to any professional fund manager, I used to be one, and B, I then spent 12 years of my life talking to them as an analyst. The one thing that any professional money manager will tell you is the one thing that gets them in more trouble than anything else is a balance sheet that's weaker than they think. And either that's through debt, it's through the pension liability, or sometimes it's through off-balance sheet liabilities like leases. And for anybody who's not used to reading an annual set of report and accounts, and I understand why, because they're not always that interesting, and frankly, they're not designed to be, you will find things like lease obligations in probably note 30 to the back of the account. So it'll be about 10 pages from the back. But if you look, even Pearson, for example, has got future guaranteed lease liabilities of about £1.3 billion. One of the reasons why Debenhams share price continues to go into the ground like a dart is that it has over £4 billion of guaranteed future leases. And they are unbreakable leases running for 15 or 20 years. Now, this isn't all cash out up front, but if you were a company looking to say, hang on, there's a bargain here, Debenhams, the share price has gone through the floorboards, you will be taking on that £4.5 billion future cash liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you're looking at a company, always think of it as somebody you own not just a percentage share of it, but the whole thing. And would you want to take on a department store that's struggling, has got too much space, and over 20 years is going to have to pay out £4.5 billion because it's going to come out of your pocket if you own the whole thing? So when you would look at an individual stock, yes, you may only have a few shares in the company and a fractional percentage ownership, but you've still got to think like an owner. And if you look at it and think, God, I wouldn't want to take on that liability, why would anybody else?
Yeah. And that's one of the Buffettism, isn't it? Warren Buffett always says, look at businesses, don't look at part owner. Yeah. Being an owner of a business, not a thing. Yeah, okay,
there
cool.
There you go.
Well,
hearing the lesson. Sorry, I hope that wasn't too preachy. Sorry about that.
No, it's good. I mean, you've been there. You've researched companies. You know all about that. So you know, it's wise words. Okay, cool. Three companies to look at quickly, Russ.
Very quickly. Cretons, Manx Telecom, and Connect. And we'll also have to quickly mention Ramsden's because we did that 10 days ago, and it's just coughed up a saying it's been cyber attacked this morning, so the shares have been a bit volatile.
Okay, good.
So Cretons is a new one that we haven't looked at before. CRL, it's a fledgling. I didn't know there were any of those left on the FTSE fledgling, but there you go. 23 million market cap. The stock has just popped on me. While I've been doing my research, the beastie things run up, so it may be one of those that we have to wait for a bit of a pullback on. But it's a personal care company, beauty brands, shampoo, conditioners, moisturisers and tanning stuff. All the stuff that you and I probably don't use that much, Justin, but you never know. But it's just come up with some great numbers in June. Sales up strongly, operating profit, and what really caught my eye and why I started doing the work was a maiden dividend, or certainly the first in absolutely ages. Only 0.23p, so let's not get carried away, but it's got net cash on the balance sheet. The brands are going well. It's actually sold some of its previous brands, and I do actually use the Real Shaving Company's product. This is also why it caught my eye.
Yeah.
It's also just acquired a company out of administration called Broad Oak so it can ramp up production capacity. So you've got net cash, maiden dividend, strong momentum, decent brands. If anything, the share price has just slightly run away from it is because it's gone from 20 to like 36p in about a month. But let's see. And it's certainly one of those companies that at least looks to have some decent products out there in what I admit is still a competitive market, but the track record overall is pretty good.
Yeah. That share price has taken off. When it released a few days ago, it went from like 24 pence to 32 pence in
time
one day.
Time waits for no man, does it, Justin? Yeah. So it probably is one of those that you might need to think, yeah, let's just let it settle and see. It does look to be an interesting company.
Cool. And the next one, Manx, is it?
Manx. Yeah, we talked about this one before. And straight away, if you're looking for big capital gains or, you know, momentum, move away, nothing to see here. If you're an income hunter, You know, it's paying about a 6% dividend yield. Okay, cover isn't great, but again, it's a telecom stock. There's relatively decent, you know, relatively guaranteed demand. It provides broadband, fixed line, and mobile services to the Isle of Man, so a relatively captive audience. Not too much competition, but enough to keep it honest. It's laying out fibre to the premises super fast, up to 100 or 200 megabits per second right now. So there's a bit of a capex program, mm-hmm. but the trading statement was perfectly solid. Cash flow positive, supporting the dividend. You got about, you know, 1.3 times dividend cover for a telecom stock is not unusual. You aren't going to get great earnings growth. You aren't going to get great share price growth. But the balance sheet's fine, and the dividend looks pretty juicy at around 5.5-6%.
Marvellous. All right, and what's the next one, Russ?
The last one is Connect, which actually connects, if you'll pardon the expression, back to Carillion. Now, when we first talked about this, you got your chart out and went, oh, look, it trades between 120p and 140p, and God help it if it goes below 120p. Yeah. You've been proven completely correct, my son. Really? It's gone through the bottom of that range and actually hit 90p yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it bounced back to a quid. Now, the share price action is saying, rather like Carillion, mm-hmm. there's trouble here, because in the end, you've now got a stock on a PE of 7 with a yield of 8.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I've looked at the Connect cash flow. Again, I reread the accounts last night. Free cash flow cover is 2.5 times. Interest cover is fantastic. Earnings cover for the dividend is about 1.5. The only question mark is the operating margin. It's a distributor of books, papers, magazines, and parcels. The operating margin is 3.5%. So again, if there is a problem, the dividend's going to look quite exposed. Now, a cut's probably already in the price. The company's got a trading statement coming up on the 24th of July, and through all of this share price carnage, has maintained a dignified silence. In fact, it confirmed the disposal of the business the other week to actually reduce its debt position even further, and the balance sheet's fine. So this is fascinating, because the market is saying, like Carillion, I don't believe the numbers. Yeah, so there's certainly a chance I've got this one wrong, and I'm getting very nervous, but the fact the company's kept a discreet silence so close to a trading statement means it's going to be really interesting. But right now, you know, with your chart looking at it, you think this is not looking pretty. The market is saying, I don't believe a word of it. Let's see what comes out on, I think it's the 24th of July.
Yeah, look at that. 1, 2, 3, awful 4, chart, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 days of falling price there. That's crazy.
Mr. Market is saying, oh, I don't like this. So we'll see what comes out. And then just very quickly, Ramsden, we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. Middlesbrough-based pawnbroker. It's just put out a statement today saying there's been a cyber attack. It is now getting in touch with customers. The share price was initially marked down 10%. The company then did say minimal disruption to business. It's rallied to being down 4, but obviously not, you know, unfortunately, a very auspicious start, given we only talked about it a couple of weeks ago. But on the face of it, at least, the underlying business, providing they've managed to keep this contained, should still be okay.
Marvellous.
So that's the lot.
RFX is a ticker there, by the way.
That is RFX AIM.
Cheers, Russ, and have a nice weekend. Speak next week, fella.
Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, Simon French. You all right,
Si? Yeah, hi, Justin. You well?
Yes, I'm good. Yes, I'm good. Does it feel good to feel like a chief every day? We can be chief.
Oh, well, I need some Indians to go with my chief. The problem is too many chiefs, not enough Indians. So, look, it's a grand title, isn't it? I hope for your listeners, I live up to the grandiose introduction you give me every week.
I do think you should put on that feather headrest more often. I mean, you know, I know you only have to wear it for, you know, monthly big meetings in the office, but I think you should wear it more often. I think.
Presumably each week I can come as a different member of the village people. To scare clients.
Exactly. Right. So what are you looking at, Si? What's the big things on your radar this week as far as the macro is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, it's global macro this week, and we've had Janet Yellen for the last 2 days testifying in front of Congress. So Janet Yellen, the Fed's chair, or at least she will be until February. Will she stay on for a second term? It's one of the big questions facing markets right now. Let's not kind of debate over personalities, but let's look ahead to some inflation data that we get out of the US economy today. And inflation is the big problem for the Fed right now, because, of course, they've raised interest rates twice. They're planning to raise interest rates a third time later this year. And they're talking about starting to reduce their $4 trillion balance sheet. So this is monetary tightening. But let's not forget, they're an inflation targeting central bank. They have a target of 2%. And the inflation numbers are likely to come in below 2%. And they've been below 2% and falling for a number of months now. So it's a bit of a mystery for Janet Yellen. And one of the problems she faces, if she's seen to be tightening at a time when inflation is below target, mm-hmm. what kind of message does that say about the credibility of the 2% target?
Yeah, exactly. So what do you think is going to happen there? I mean, in your mind, they're not going to be tightening, are they?
Well, this is the problem, is that if I was a data-dependent central bank and they tell me that they all are, then I'd be saying, well, I'm not hitting a key, you know, 50% of my mandate. They've got another mandate to maximise employment, which they're doing very well on. It has to be said, the US labour market's very strong. But if I'm not hitting the other 50% of my mandate, I shouldn't really be tightening until I know why I'm not hitting that. But it appears that the Fed have been stung by the criticism of 2016, where they said, well, we're going to raise rates three, maybe four times, and then they only raised them the once. So it feels to me then they're not being data dependent at the moment. They're trying to restore their credibility and say to markets, look, this cheap money, this negative, you know, zero interest rate, near zero interest rates is not forever. We're going to reintroduce tighter money into the economy, even though it isn't necessarily consistent with below target inflation. So I actually think they're going to press on. The big question mark, though, is what they do in 2018. And there have been indications from a speech by Lael Brainard, she's another member of the Fed's Open Markets Committee, who said, look, when we start balance sheet reduction, start to reduce the number of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities we hold, we may hold the pause on further interest rate hikes while we see how markets respond. So I think we may see fewer interest rate hikes in 2018 than we've had this year.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, so let's I know you've got something on the UK here in credit, and I've seen quite a bit, this come up quite a few times this week, and I think it was the Bank of England warning banks about lending or being too lax on their on their thing. So are we in a worrying, so take us through some of the figures what you have, or what you, and are we in a worrying environment?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a number of people, and I think rightly so, looking at the amount of unsecured lending. So this is credit cards, loans, car finance, which is growing at about 10% year on year, and saying, wow, that's a fast rate of growth when the economy in nominal terms is probably only growing about 3.5% to 4%, and in real terms, less than 2%. You're going, well, look, we need to sort of get a handle on whether consumers are riding the debt cycle like they did ahead of the financial crisis. And I think there's a few things you need to look at here. First of all is underwriting standards. So this is the assessment that lenders make ahead of offering you credit. And are we back at the pre-financial crisis levels when you had a lot of self-certification, very lax underwriting standards? No, I don't think we are. But I do think the PRA, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, and the FCA are looking at this area going, but even if though it isn't back to those sort of slightly crazy days, we need to be vigilant because a lot of new lenders, challenger banks, a lot of peer-to-peer lenders who are coming new to the market, they're all trying to play or are playing by the banking license rules. But inevitably, when you get that many new entrants and disruptors into the marketplace, some of them try and sort of squeeze around the rules. So this is what the bank's saying regarding being quite vigilant. Mm-hmm. The other part of the unsecured credit story is whether householders are having to deal with this inflation spike and this lack of wage growth by taking on more debt than they can actually manage, and they're going to get the sting in the tail if, and it's a big if, interest rate rises go up in the future. And I think that is the other thing that the Bank of England and the regulators are trying to get ahead of.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, it's not now. It's if you're having trouble, you know, paying off some of your loans, whatever, now in this lower, you know, interest rate environment, what happens in a couple of years' time if we're a couple of percent up, you know, higher? So that's the worrying thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Justin, you and I are old enough to remember when interest rates went up. But there was a whole there is a whole generation of borrowers. Anybody who has borrowed money since 2007-08 will not know if they're on a floating rate. They won't know higher interest rates. They won't know there's an educational piece of having to budget each week or each month when potentially one of your big costs, in the case of mortgage, but also in the case of unsecured loans, might be linked to the Bank of England rates. And if they start to raise rates, then how do households respond? Do they have the knowledge of how to manage finances? So, I mean, there is a famous, or maybe not very famous, but he is in economic circles, economist called Minsky, who says that if you have these long periods of very, very loose money, very, very relaxed markets, you lose the kind of institutional knowledge. Everyone becomes so relaxed, expects those conditions to go on forever. And it creates instability and sows the seeds effectively for the next crisis, and that is worrying a lot of people, and I would guess rightly so.
Yeah. Well, I assume, like I said, a lot of people now who are looking at mortgages probably think interest rates are largely irrelevant, but they're not. You know, they will be until it starts rising. Then they'll see the effects of how damaged it can be if they've taken on too much. Okay.
Well, I have my own theory, just quickly on this, Justin.
Which I'd love to hear your own theory. Go on.
Yeah. So if you're a household and you think, well, actually, if I keep leveraging up on credit card debt, on mortgage debt, on loan debt, then, I mean, maybe they're not all economics PhDs, but let's give the great British public and the global public their credit and say, if you excuse the pun, actually, if we are so indebted, central banks are never going to raise interest rates, because they know that if they do, they would start to, through the wealth effect, start to push out consumer spending or reduce consumer spending. And maybe the householders have caught the central banks in a trap that they can't get out of it. And actually, it's not Mark Carney who's laughing, but it's the great British public who've gone, ha-ha, you cannot raise interest rates while we're as indebted as we are.
I think in your theory, you're very kind to the British public, but I think you're giving them too much credit of economic policy. I do. I think they don't think of it as a mass, as they're saying, they'll never put it up now because it's too much for some borrowing. It'll damage the economy. They don't have that much insight. You have a lot more insight.
I need to get out more, don't
you? Yeah, I think so. You chat to the average person, and they don't think en masse about the credit situation of the country. I think they just think, oh, I'll just get a new flat screen. To watch the footy on. What's coming up next week, Simon? What's to look out for?
Yeah, so next week, a couple of data points for investors to look out for. On Tuesday, we get the UK inflation numbers. 2.9% is the current level, so above the Bank of England's target. Will it push to 3 and above? And will that force the hand of the Monetary Policy Committee at the bank on the 3rd of August when they next consider UK rates? I think we're seeing signs that inflation is starting to peak. You're starting to see that big collapse in the pound and the big appreciation in the oil price starting to leave the measure of inflation, because that happened now more than 12 months ago. So I think you're going to start to see inflation peaking and hopefully heading back down towards 2%. So that's a big number to look out for on Tuesday morning. Then Wednesday morning, retail sales. And retail sales have been a bit patchy in 2017. So those consumers you were talking about buying flat screen tellies, they've just been a bit more cautious as they've seen all the mad political headlines sloshing about and worrying about tighter underwriting measures for credit. So retail sales, good bellwether data point. Will the UK consumer continue to spend, or will they rein it in? I think it's there's quite a mixed picture, and any more intel we can get will help us indicate whether we get a decent growth performance in the second half of this year.
Exactly. I do think people now are becoming more aware of the uncertainty of what's out there, and maybe they are being a bit more careful about things. But there we are. That's my feeling on it. So thanks very much for that, and have a nice weekend. Speak next week.
My pleasure. Speak soon, Justin. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, UK Oil and Gas, UKOG. At 4, Ascent Resources, AST. At 3, Angus Energy, ANGS. At 2, New Oil and Gas. That's New Oil and Gas. Easy for me to say. It's NUOG. And number 1, we talked about them with Russ earlier on. Carillion, after that massive fall, 50% down, huge debt pile. That's CLLN. People taking a punt on that. Okay, top five most liked RNSs on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours were: at five, Red Rock Resources. That's RRR, Jupiter Mines update. At four, Pantheon Resources, PANR, operations update. At three, Independent Oil and Gas, award of new license. At two, Savannah Petroleum, out yesterday, statement regarding media speculation. And number one, most liked RNS released, I think, yesterday afternoon, was it? It's an MOD Resources update, an investment update by Metal Tiger, MTR. By the way, going to number two, Savannah Petroleum, very interesting. Seven Energy, there's media speculation about a reverse takeover of that. So it's a big move for Savannah. If it happens, of course. That's SAVP, worth keeping an eye on. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.